Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course, I'm Al Warren. Now, today, we have New York Times best-selling author, and he's got a fairly recent book out, just came out at the end of June here on the 21st, and it's called The Lies I Tell. So, Julie Clark, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, you've got a few books out here, and I guess The Last Flight was quite the big novel for you, that kind of broke, as we say. How did you get into writing?
I always wanted to be a writer. When I was little, I would write stories. Fiction was always a place that I used to escape. I would go to libraries. I would frequent bookstores. It was always the weekend treat to go to the bookstore and buy a bunch of books. And so I would read books and I would always think like, oh, I want to write books like that, you know, but then you grow up and you realize like a creative fiction writing degree is not exactly what you want to pin your financial hopes on as a 20-something-year-old. And so, you know, life kind of takes over and I fell into teaching and have been a teacher for the last 25 years. And it wasn't until my early 40s that I really took a step back and thought, you know, is this the only thing that I really want to do in my life? And the writing idea had never really gone away. I'm a voracious reader still, many books a week. And I was still getting that pang of like, I want to write something. And so I did. I think when I was like 43 or 44, I started writing a book, and I didn't really tell anybody that I was writing. I just kind of did it for myself to see if I could do it. You know, you hear stories about people who, you know, start books but never finish them. And I didn't know whether that would be me or not. And so I wrote a book, finished the book, revised the book, tried to get an agent with that book and could not. So then I had a different idea for another book. And I knew that I had been able to write one book. So clearly I know how to do it. I just didn't know yet how to do it well. And so it just took a little bit of time. And my second book that I wrote turned out to be my debut, The Ones We Choose, which released in 2018. And then, of course, The Last Flight in 2020, and now The Lies I Tell in 2022. So here I am.
Yeah. Was there a particular incident or something that kind of drove you to actually writing a story? Because there's always that part of a writer that kind of goes, well, you know, I want to write, and they write. Mm-hmm. But there has to be something else that kind of causes you to actually try to let the world see it, like send it out, talk to a publisher or agents and stuff, and try to get your work out in the public. Like there must be, because that's kind of the big step that a lot of people don't take.
Yeah. I mean, I just kind of felt like I had spent so many hours doing that I felt like, you know, it would be not wasted time, because I'm always a believer of like that time would have passed anyway. And it was a good, enjoyable use of my time. It's not like I hated every minute of it. But I sort of felt like, you know, I'm a teacher. I am, you know, barely making ends meet. I might as well see if I can make some money, you know? And so it was really about like seeing if I could actually turn this into a second career for myself.
Yeah. And it's funny when you say you go to the library, or you did, to kind of escape in a sense, or you kind of were into that. Mm-hmm. Did you not like real people?
I do. I'm definitely an introvert for sure. I get overloaded sometimes with social interactions and need time to recover. But I mean, I do like people, but you know, the thing about books is that it allows you to travel and be a million different people without ever, you know, leaving your chair, wherever that chair may be, whether it be at a library or whether it be at home. It was magical to me. It was magical that I could go to many different times and places and experience things that I would never experience in real life. And so to be able to do that for readers is a gift.
Now, when The Last Flight came out, it was a pretty big success. Mm-hmm. And how did that affect you? Like, how do you find that you reacted to that?
Mostly astonished, you know, like I really felt strongly about that book. I felt like it had a great hook. I felt like there was an audience for it. But with publishing, you can have a fantastic book with a fantastic hook that's very well written, and the book can still flop for no reason other than the way the market is, or the way, you know, the publisher promotes it or doesn't. And so having a fantastic book doesn't necessarily guarantee that you're going to have a hit. You know, anybody in publishing will tell you that, like it's not a guarantee. So it was a relief. I was astonished at the level of attention that the book got, and just overjoyed. You know, it's what you dream of as a writer when you sit down and you toil those hours every morning for years, that you will get to that moment. So it was wonderful.
For me myself, when I did the very first book and for a publisher, and it was just a short read, part of a series. Mm-hmm. And the first week they sold 44,000 copies.
That's incredible.
And it scared me. I don't know if you had that feeling, but all of a sudden I became, because I kind of didn't expect it. And I'm not sure that I wanted it, if that makes sense, because now there's the point where you're like, now what? I mean, because how do you follow up? Because, you know, all of a sudden, everything I do, I'm worried that, they're going to compare it, you know, because Above Suspicion was that book, and they're going to turn around and go, well, this is okay, but it's not Above Suspicion. You know what I mean? Like that people do that, not in a bad way. It's just a reaction.
Yeah. I mean, it's their right to say, I prefer this book over that book. You know, I mean, I do it myself with books that I know that I love by authors that I love. You know, I liked this book, but I didn't like it as much as that book. You know, I mean, it's what we do as a writer. I think you kind of have to let go of that. You can't, you know, all you can do is try to do the very best that you can do. And I think also understand that you can't recreate that magic for whatever book that was magical. Like, I think it's a mistake to try to tap into that again in the same way, in the same vein, you know, like I think that you can take some of the things that you know worked and try to turn it into something new. But I think if you're trying to live up to whatever a book was, I think that's where you sort of lose your creative vision of what else you can do that might be different and even better, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It certainly takes away your attention. It takes your, it directs your focus to something that isn't really about writing anymore. So I will say that it's a learned thing, but now I'm old. Yes. It doesn't matter. I've learned that, but the lies I tell. So, when you were putting this together, did you think about The Last Flight at all, or was it even on your mind?
I mean, I did, you know, I obviously knew that, you know, I actually wanted to stay away from a dual POV, dual timeline book. I thought that was really, really hard. I don't want to do that again. And then of course, that's sort of what I ended up with. You realize at some point, like, no, I'm going to need to do that again. Okay. And you know, I did it a little bit differently this time, but I do feel like, you know, every book you write sort of informs the next book as well. Not necessarily just the topic or the subject matter, but also the process. Every book is different, but I also think that there are things that work that, you know, like, okay, that really worked for me last time as far as how to get this story out, when to get this story out, and like how to organize my thoughts, my ideas, my drafting. I think that, you know, every book gets a little bit easier, not necessarily in a, I've got this down, I can crank them out, you know, every 3 months, like not like that, but just sort of, you know, what works for you and what doesn't work for you. And you can save yourself some time by not trying those things that didn't work.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a learning process.
Yeah.
So with this new book, how did you come up with the premise or the idea? So let's maybe talk about the basic premise of it. And then where did that come from?
So The Lies I Tell is the story of Meg Williams, who's a female con artist traveling the country under assumed names. She's creating elaborate backstories to back up whatever lies she's telling in order to, you know, con specific people that she has targeted. Her goal isn't necessarily to get rich, although that's a nice byproduct of what she does. But her goal is really to build the skills that she will need to be able to go home and take down the man who she believes destroyed her childhood, stole her family home, landed her living in her car right out of high school. She really blames this person for kind of the destruction of her life and derailing it completely. But what she doesn't know is that there's an investigative reporter named Kat Roberts in Los Angeles waiting for her to return. And Kat has her own idea of revenge. She was collateral damage on a con that Meg pulled many years ago. And Kat is going to infiltrate Meg's life under an assumed name with an elaborate backstory that none of it is true. And as the two women sort of circle each other with their lies and see who can hook who into whatever scheme she's got going, you're never really sure, like, what the con is and who the true target is.
So where does that come from? Like, did you know someone like this character, or did you just get the idea from something you had saw or someone you'd met? Or
I got the idea. I was listening to a podcast called Who the Hell is Hamish, which is about this Australian man who would, you know, charming and engaging and dynamic, and he would get these women to fall in love with him, and then he would tell them about these like $50,000 investments that, you know, can't lose, right? And I remember I was listening to it and I'm thinking, like, first of all, who falls for this? And second, I think a woman could do this better. I think a woman would be a better con artist than a man, because we're less threatening, I think, in a lot of ways. We don't, when we approach people, we don't send up the same alarm signals that, you know, sometimes get sent up with men. And so at that point, I just started thinking about a female con artist and why she might be conning people. And, you know, it's never really interesting if she's a sociopath, just out to take advantage of people. So I wanted to give her a backstory that helped sort of put her grifting into context, I think, for readers a little bit. So, you know, she lives in this morally gray area where she's doing bad things, but she's doing them for what she believes are the right reasons. And the reader can kind of see that and understand that and still root for her, even though she's doing bad things.
So how do you, work with your characters? For instance, this one, this is your main character here. Mm-hmm. How is it that you experience her? Is this a sort of a visual? Do you, is it like a movie to you, or is it like a voice in the head? Like, how do you do this?
It's probably more visual for me. I mean, I definitely always approach it from, like, as a reader, what is it that I want? Like, what would I want right here and right now? You know what I mean? And so that to me is really where I start. And then I kind of go from there. And then I start kind of backtracking and thinking about, like, what's her backstory? What's, you know, some of the baggage that she carries? What are some of her heartbreaks? What are some of her triumphs? What did she struggle with? What was high school like for her? You know, these are some of the things that I need to know as the writer, so that when she's on the page for you, you get a sense of all of that life that she's lived. So she feels three-dimensional.
It's interesting. So when you experience this and you're going through and you're writing this character, do they sometimes go in a direction you probably didn't see coming?
Sometimes. I mean, I generally know going into a book sort of what my opening scene is. And it's very visual for me. I can get the sense of, like, what it looks like, what it sounds like. And I generally know sort of like what the big twist is in the middle. And then I have a very clear idea about what I want my last scene to be. And once I get that into place, I can kind of write toward those things. Things change, obviously, as you're writing. Relationships between characters need to change and grow and morph, and that's not working. So I've got to go back and make them less friendly or more friendly. Things do change. I don't know that, like, my characters go off on some kind of, you know, journey and I'm the follower just taking down. I don't see it as I'm their scribe, but I more see it as like, I know how a book needs to work, and I need to figure out the plot to make that happen. And so sometimes I've got to take things out, rewrite things, move things around. If there's some big conflict between two characters, I know it needs to happen at a certain point, and so I have to write toward that versus just like feeling it, sensing, you know what I mean? Like, it's not always an intuitive thing. Sometimes it's like very concrete, like something needs to happen here.
Yeah, that's interesting. I see it that way too. But, because I'm primarily nonfiction, and a lot of the writers we've talked to on the show are fiction. And I get a lot of people that say, you know, they describe their characters as if they're like their children or family, yes, or friends and stuff like that. Do you have a description or an idea, or how do you see your characters?
I mean, I definitely see them as people I've invented them. So it's almost like they're my children, right? Like, sometimes I don't always, you know, agree with what they're doing, but I need them to be doing these things in order to accomplish these plot goals that I have for them, you know? And so, you know, in thinking about the theme, like, they're there to serve the theme of the book. And, you know, my goal is to present people who are compelling and interesting and flawed and complicated, you know, someone that you'd want to spend time with for 300 plus pages. And so, you know, in order to do that, they have to be real to me. Definitely.
Yeah. So I always find it. It's kind of a strange thing when people.
It is weird. Yeah.
You know, worry about people, you know, hearing voices and stuff, right?
No, no voices in my head, but I do.
You don't wake up with a shovel in your hand.
Yeah. Nothing like that. But I do. I mean, they are, you know, they are with me all day long, every day. You know, I am thinking about them a lot as I'm walking the dog, as I'm washing the dishes, as I'm walking the aisles of the supermarket. You know, I am thinking about things, even when I'm not really aware that I'm thinking about them. I'm still thinking about them.
Well, that's funny. You know, if you're in, so you're in the supermarket and you're shopping, and then you're thinking sort of about maybe a character and, you know, where they're going to go or how they develop or whatever, you're kind of going through something and stuff. Do you think that where you are sometimes affects how you're going to write that character then?
I definitely think so. And I also believe very strongly that if you stay open to ideas, solutions will appear for you. So if you're having a plot problem or you're having a character problem or you don't really know how you're going to resolve something, like, just open up your mind and go out into the world and see sort of what the universe offers up to you. And that to me, you know, has been always a surprise. It sounds a little woo, but I also just think, like, you know, the right podcast will land in your lap when you need it, you know, and the right idea will occur to you if you stay open to it, which might require you to completely take out chapter 2 and make chapter 2 chapter 12, which is like, nobody wants to do that, but sometimes that's what you have to do.
Yeah. Yeah. You kind of have to go with it. But you're an outliner, it sounds like. So you kind of outline the story. You kind of know the beginning, middle, end sort of idea, and you kind of fill it in. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'd say it's a very loose outline, and I have tried to be a little bit more like, chapter 1 is this, chapter 2 is this, chapter 3 is this. And I have a tendency, if I do that, then I feel like I'm too locked in to my first idea. And I know, and I'm sure you know too, like, your first idea is never your best idea. It's just your first idea. And so by writing everything down like that, then I have a hard time breaking away from that to let the magical things happen as you're drafting a book. So I have a loose idea of beginning and end and middle, and then the rest is pretty wide open as I write.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty interesting. Your supporting characters, so are they developed the same way, or do you have sort of, or you just find them in a coffee shop type thing, or you're kind of going along and you pick up something, or where do they come from?
Same. I mean, you know, sometimes, so for the lies I tell, you know, Meg Williams was the character, my con artist, that came to me first. And then, as you know, when you're thinking about a book, you're thinking, okay, well, somebody needs to be after her. Well, what would be like the worst thing for Meg to have, the worst kind of person for Meg to be after her? I mean, I guess the police would be pretty bad, but I didn't really want to write a police procedural. That was sort of not my interest. I love reading them, but I'm not really interested in writing one. So I thought, okay, so not the police, who could it be? Why not a former victim, or maybe somebody who was an accidental victim, right? I didn't want Meg to recognize her or know her in any way. And so, you know, at that point, you know, Kat became an investigative reporter who's going to use all of her skills that she's learned to sort of take Meg down. And, you know, she's imagining, you know, like a Ronan Farrow type of like expose in the New Yorker or the Atlantic or something, where she could really make a name for herself, you know, and reclaim what was stolen from her. And so, you know, those are the things that come to you as you're starting to think about a new book. And okay, who are the people going to, how am I going to populate this new book with people, kind of people are going to be in it? And what is it that they all want? And what is it that they all.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need and those two things absolutely have to be different, you know, and Meg's wants and needs need to be in conflict with Kat's.
Wow. So, you know, at the end of the day, so someone comes and picks up The Lies I Tell. Mm-hmm. And they read it. Mm-hmm. So under that entertainment value and the story, what is it you want them to take away? Or is there something?
I mean, I always want readers to take away something from my books. It's sort of, you know, I can't finish writing a book until I know what it's really about. And it's never about like being a con artist is fun. You know, no, it's about bigger themes of, you know, female empowerment and how do we balance the scales in a society that is weighted against us? How is it that women can prop each other up instead of tear each other down, you know? And Meg and Kat sort of approach these questions from different places, and yet at the same time, I think they would both agree that they're actually on the same page when it comes to things like that. You know, they both have been victims, they both have been traumatized, and a lot of it has to do with, you know, when women don't look out for other women, or, you know, powerful men who take advantage of their position in the world. And so kind of balancing the scales of karma, I think most readers in the world today, not even just female readers, but readers in general, see a lot of injustice out in the world that doesn't ever seem to get balanced. You know, we're all waiting for karma to hit this person or that person, and karma can take a really long time. And so, you know, to have a character like Meg Williams come along who's balancing those scales in the way that she knows how and in a way that she's very good at, it's delightful, you know. So
I wonder, so do you feel like do you feel a little bit of pressure when you write with some big subtext like that? Do you feel a little bit of pressure to make sure you're doing it justice and not really upsetting anyone?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to walk a fine line. And I don't know that my books are for everybody, but I also, you know, overwhelmingly get messages from readers all over the country, all over the world, actually, that are thanking me for, you know, giving them a voice. And I would say even with The Last Flight, you know, the demographic that really responded to my book was not just women, it was men as well. A lot of male readers loved that book. And so I would expect and have seen so far the same kind of split, that it isn't just a female story for women. It's about empowerment in general. And it's about taking your power back when somebody in a position of power has taken it from you.
Right.
I think we've all experienced that.
Because it's a fine line on how you take it back, right? I'd imagine.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and I would say that like not really anybody that I know would take it back the way that Meg is taking it back, you know? So, yeah, that's the fun part of fiction though, you know, is that you can go along for that ride and, you know, it's like the secret fantasy that everybody has of like, oh, you know, someday, that person will, you know, get their just desserts or whatever it is. And I think that, you know, it's not just, sometimes people don't want to wait. And so it's fun to watch a character do that, you know, because we can't really.
Right. It's just sort of at the point where some of you is in the character, because every writer said, you know, there's always something. So it's just kind of like, what you would like to do, let's say if you were her, or maybe something in real life sometime.
I mean, no, because I would be a terrible con artist. I'm a horrible liar. I am honest to a fault, and I do believe in karma. And so, you know, I don't think that it is my responsibility to, you know, enact revenge or justice or whatever that is. We have systems in place for that. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a part of me that wouldn't delight in seeing that happen, you know?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. it's the fun part of it, right?
Right.
So do you like the whole new world, like the social media and the the aspect where so many people can be in touch with you so quickly? Like, you know,
I'm wary of it. I mean, you know, I wrote a whole book about how social media can be used to target you. But I also think that, you know, it's a necessary tool for authors at this point. You know, it's something that we have to do. It's hard. It's very hard. I've been on the road for 2 weeks in, you know, 15 different events. And so it's been challenging to stay on top of social media when you're busy with other things. And, you know, I'm a parent as well and a teacher. And so it's a lot to juggle. Sometimes I have to just say, like, I can't manage that right now. And I think that sometimes we also have access to more information than our human lizard brains can process. And that's not necessarily a good thing. You know, we just can't, there's so much information that it's almost impossible for us to sort of sort it and parse it and figure out what it all means, because it comes at us so, so fast.
Yeah. And so many different directions. Do you follow up on like, reviews and things like that? Are you mindful of what goes on around your books?
I try to be. I'm not a big reader of my reviews. I learned early on that in order to focus on the work that I can control, I can't start focusing on other people's feelings about my books. I mean, I appreciate every good review that I get and, you know, try to respond as best I can when, you know, it's directed at me. But like, I'm not looking on Amazon at my reviews. I'm not looking on Goodreads at my reviews. It's just a hole that, you know, you'd never come out of. And so, you know, my belief is that the reviews are for readers to help each other find books that they will enjoy. And, you know, that's sort of the guideposts for them. Reviews don't necessarily inform how I'm working on my next book. So it's not really something I really have to do, kind of live inside a tunnel when I'm working on a project. And so, you know, trying to keep out all the distractions and all the noise of hype can be challenging at times.
Now that's interesting, because when you talk about distractions and noise, so when you sit down to write, can you assign times? Can you kind of go, okay, listen, it's Saturday and there's nobody home, no school, I got nothing to do for 4 hours here. Can you just sort of sit down and go, okay, I'm going to write starting at 11. You sit down, go and just write. And can you can do that?
Yeah. I mean, I have to, with everything else going on in my life. Like, if I don't carve out that time to write, then it's just not ever going to happen. You know, if I waited until I felt like writing, I just never would. You know, you have to treat it like a job, and then you have to show up at the job.
Yeah. But you know, so when there's things going on, like I think I can relate in the sense that, you know, I've got a lot going on and you're kind of just trying to do things, and you can balance that while you write. But when there's unusual things, like, for instance, in the last couple of years, all the crazy stuff going on, you know, I could go 100 places with that, you know, from politics to, you know, to the pandemic and masks and no masks and vaccines being Bill Gates and all this stuff, you know, all this stuff flying around outside of your door and everywhere you look. Does that ever affect you or your way of writing?
I definitely think it seeps into the things that I write and the themes that I try to tackle. You know, I mean, I feel like you can't live your life in a vacuum, but I also try to be very protective of my writing time so that when I sit down to write, it really is about the story at the time and not letting outside things sort of seep into to distract me and drag me into places that I don't have time to go. There's other times of the day where I allow myself to go those places, but my writing time is usually first thing in the morning, very, very early, and it's pretty protected. I don't veer too much away from it.
Yeah. I just wonder, but like if things are stressful and tense, you know, like you, something really negative, if you think that maybe that will come out in maybe some of your characters?
Maybe. I mean, you know, it's really hard to know where my characters come from in the sense that, you know, they don't evolve fully formed on the page from day one. They evolve over time. I'm getting to know them as I'm creating them. And if there are certain things that are happening in the news cycle that might fit with what I am trying to say as well, I may use it. You know, I definitely think that Meg and Kat are both current characters for our times, and that is definitely informed by what's happening in the world today.
Yeah, it's crazy. How much do you think of your own life do you put into this?
Very little. I mean, I'm not a con artist. I'm not an investigator.
No, but I mean, I was thinking more like, okay, so your life is in your teacher and you're all this. How much of your own experience do you think that runs into it? Not necessarily you as in personality.
I think, like, you know, every time a character is faced with a crossroads, every time they need to make a decision, you know, I have to stop and think, like, what would I do? How would I react to this? What decisions would I make? Now for Meg, I would probably then do the opposite of what I would, you know? And so, but that's the fun of writing characters that aren't me, you know, but what would I do is always the first question. How would I feel in this moment right now? And sometimes I can use it and sometimes I have to be the opposite.
Yeah. It's a, you know, well, so what are you working on now?
It's pretty early days, but it's about a family murder in 1975 and how it's kind of playing out in this family decades later.
Oh, do these types of book take a lot out of you? Like when you're going through something like that or something that's pretty, I mean, that sounds like it could be kind of deep and a little bit disturbing. So when you're doing that, do you find it takes a toll on you?
It doesn't, because, you know, for me, it's not about the murder. It's about the characters and how that murder impacts their lives moving forward, which I find to be a much more interesting and also kind of less scary space. You know, bad things happen to everybody. In every family, we have bad things that have happened, not necessarily murder, but illness, you know, death, you know, trauma of any kind. And so for me as a writer, I'm not really interested in focusing on that trauma itself as much as I'm interested in focusing on the aftermath of the trauma and how it has a ripple effect into people's lives many, many years later.
Wow. So how do you like people to find you? Or do you? I mean, like, do you have a website? How are you?
I have a website, julieclarkauthor.com. I'm on Instagram mostly. That's my main platform, Instagram. So Julie Clark Author on Instagram. I am on Facebook at Julie Clark Books, but less so. I mean, it's pretty much a duplicate of whatever's on Instagram.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much it. I mean, I'm on Twitter peripherally, but not really for a lot of book promotion.
Well, fantastic. Of course, we're going to have that up on our website and all the locations for people to find you. So, well, that's great. So where do you see yourself going with all this? Like, it's sort of come late in your life and you're kind of doing well. What's happening? I mean, are you going to quit teaching and live on luxury now? Or
all the authors in the audience are laughing.
Yeah.
I think no. You know, I like teaching. I like the job. I like working with kids. It's a really good distraction for publishing, I think. You know, when you go into a classroom and you need to figure out how, you know, this kid or that kid is going to learn how to do long division, like, it pretty much takes up all your time and all your mental space. And it's great. It's a really great place to go and forget about plot problems and publishing problems and promotion problems. It's a great place to go and kind of step away from social media for 6 hours a day. And sort of it's refreshing, you know, it's energizing in a different way that writing is. So I'm lucky that I get to do two jobs that I love equally in different ways.
You know, you could probably give good advice for someone, let's say that they are writing, they haven't published, or they haven't been to an agent, they haven't, maybe because they're scared, or maybe they're not sure, and maybe because they are a little older, maybe they're in their 30s or early 40s and sort of kind of going, well, it's too late, you know, and stuff like that. What kind of things would you tell them that were the best pieces of advice for yourself and how you did it?
I think the best piece of advice came from a book written by Sandra Schofield, who wrote a book called The Scene Book, which kind of helps you sort of narrow in on scenes and make them impactful and powerful. But I actually got the writing advice from her introduction before she even like started talking about scenes. And it basically said, you know, in order to publish your book, you need to do two things. Number one, you need to think of yourself as a worker. And number two, you need to show up at the job. I mean, that's really all it is being persistent and consistent and doing it every day as if it were a paid job. And eventually it will be a paid job.
Do you think it's important to have a good editor or a good person to that you can trust that can kind of go through?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. I mean, I have readers, writer friends who are readers for me. I read for them. And their input and eye is critical, critical, critical. So absolutely. And if you don't know where to find those people, I would suggest, you know, Facebook groups is a great place. You can find writer groups on Facebook. They're all over the place. If you are female or female identifying, the Binders group is a great place that's still around on Facebook for lots of different pockets of writing. But you can do, you know, online classes where you'll meet other people sort of at your stage of writing where you can find a critique partner. I mean, that's where I found my very first critique partner in a UCLA extension class that I took. So, you know, and just building your community.
Yeah. Who are your favorite people then? Like who give you inspiration? They don't have to be writers, just people out there that always kind of lift you up.
That I know or just like in general?
Well, in general, like they don't have to be personal, but just people like maybe a singer or an actor or maybe a writer.
I would say that for me, my writing influences were definitely Barbara Kingsolver. I read everything that she wrote. She actually wrote a book of nonfiction, like essays about, it's called High Tide in Tucson. And there was a chapter in there about how in other countries, they all kind of pitch in to parent other people's children in a way that we don't here in the US. And that essay really inspired me to actually go back and teach many, many years ago. And so I would definitely say Barbara Kingsolver is one. I would say Anna Quindlen is another one. Some of her parenting essays that she's written have been spot on. And her fiction also is just beautiful, beautiful. So I would say probably those two are the biggest sort of creative influences that I've had.
Well, that's fantastic, you know. Well, we really appreciate coming on the show. Now, the book is called The Lies I Tell, and it's a novel. And our guest has been the author, Julie Clark. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.